This video is brought to you by Nebula. Hi, welcome to another episode of Cold Fusion. This is an illustration of what people in 1899 thought the year 2000 would look like, a very accurate depiction of a policeman and firefighter taking to the skies with their paper wings. Clearly, this is exactly the kind of technology we have today. Spot on. But in all seriousness, just think of what the creator of these images would think of the planes we have today. The point is, human flight itself is amazing and has been ever since it was achieved in 1903. As we started to get the hang of it, humans tried to fly ever faster, but the race to fly faster than sound itself was one of the most thrilling and daring challenges of the 20th century. As planes approached the speed of sound, they behaved strangely. They would buffet, shake, and even just disintegrate. Some unbelievable attempts included a volatile rocket plane and a propeller so powerful that it tried to rotate the very plane that it was attached to. It was a crazy time, but many men did sadly lose their life in the pursuit of supersonic flight. But after humans achieved this feat, the Concorde was the only commercial application, and after the Concorde went out of service, it seemed like we collectively just kind of gave up on commercial supersonic flight. Or did we? As you'll see at the end of this episode, there's recently been new life in the sector of commercial supersonic flight. So, today, we'll take a look at the enthralling and dangerous journey of humans breaking the sound barrier, and then we'll finish off with the latest activity in the industry. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the journey.
You are watching Cold Fusion TV.
For those of us with hearing, we're all used to hearing sound every day, but when you think about it, it's blisteringly fast. At sea level, the speed of sound is approximately 1,225 kilometers an hour, or 751 miles per hour. Obviously, supersonic flight refers to flying faster than the speed of sound, but what do we call speeds higher than that? A ratio is used called the Mach number. Mach 1 is equal to the speed of sound, Mach 2 is twice as fast, and so on. So supersonic flight means flying above Mach 1. The man who took this photo is responsible for that term. His name is Ernst Mach, and in 1887, he somehow managed to capture a bullet moving at supersonic speeds. This was the first visual imagery of a shockwave. It allowed scientists to study what happens when an object travels at incredible speeds. Since the advent of human flight, the desire to go faster than the speeding bullet was tempting. For a long time, aeronautical technology only allowed this to remain a curiosity. That was up until the build-up to World War II.
The fateful hour of 11 has struck, and Britain's final warning to Hitler having been ignored, a state of war once more exists between Great Britain and Germany.
Governments and engineers were interested in producing ever faster planes. They wanted any advantage they could get in combat. But there was a major problem. Every plane used propellers to fly, and as it turns out, when a propeller blade aircraft gets close to the speed of sound, the propellers lose their efficiency and sometimes tear themselves apart. Wings would abruptly lose lift and the control surfaces would stop working. This would effectively cause planes to fall out of the sky. Sometimes catastrophic failure would occur and the plane would simply just break up. There was an interesting case of an experimental supersonic propeller aircraft, the Republic XF-84H Thunder Screech. So why was it called such a weird name like Thunder Screech? The plane was so loud that it caused seizures and vomiting for those who were unlucky enough to hear it. That was because the propellers themselves were actually supersonic, and this caused thousands of sonic booms per second. The propeller was so strong that in flight, it tries to rotate the plane instead of the other way around. Of course, this is almost cartoonish, and it was seeming that planes simply couldn't go any faster. Then came the Germans, led by a certain crazy man. German engineers were actually the first to explore the possibility of supersonic flight. They wanted to dominate air-to-air combat during World War II. One design was a simple rocket engine with wings, basically. It was called the Messerschmitt ME-163, nicknamed the Comet. With its highly volatile fuels, it could reach a speed of 800 kilometers an hour, or about 500 miles an hour. That was enough to outpace anything in the sky at the time. However, it still fell short of breaking supersonic speed during level flight. Its rocket-powered engine burned through all of its fuel in just 7.5 minutes. During that time, it covered 82 kilometers. The thing was, it then had to glide back to base, often under enemy fire. Even worse, its fuel was so highly corrosive that it sometimes burnt the pilots. A prototype ME-163A in 1941, piloted by Hinay Ditmar, was the first plane to exceed 1,000 kilometers an hour. The same pilot later reached 1,130 kilometers an hour, this time in an ME-163B. Although close, this is still below the speed of sound. The ME-163 couldn't reach supersonic speeds because it had some major problems, aside from being a death trap. When it got close to the speed of sound, it would shake so violently that the vibrations would cause structural damage. And those same vibrations could lead to a loss of control. German engineers tried to solve this problem, but were ultimately unsuccessful. The Germans weren't the only ones giving it a shot. Back in 1942, while the world was still at war, the British government was desperate to gain an edge over Germany in the air, so they started a secret project. The goal was to make the world's first supersonic aircraft. The project was led by two brothers, George Miles and F.G. Miles. The result was the M-52, a jet-powered plane with a bullet-shaped body and short, straight wings. The M-52 had a new, all-moving tail, which was needed for high-speed control. The aircraft was meant to fly at 1,000 miles per hour, or Mach 1.4, and reach an altitude of 36,000 feet in just less than 2 minutes. It was a bold and ambitious project, but it faced a whole bunch of engineering problems, and the project kept stalling. We'll catch back up with this team later in the episode. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, the Americans were also working on their own supersonic project. They wanted to investigate aerodynamic conditions within the transonic speed range. They wanted to crack the code and be the first to fly faster than the speed of sound. But in order to do this, they needed to build a plane and research what happens when you get close to the speed of sound. Before we get to the plane and the man who broke the sound barrier, a question has to be asked. Why do so many things go so wrong when you try to pass the speed of sound? As an object nears the speed of sound, air molecules compress and it creates a shockwave, the very same type of wave that Ernst Mach took a photo of in 1887. This wave causes a sudden rise in temperature and pressure, and this affects the object's aerodynamics and stability. The phenomena leads to less lift, more drag, and violent vibrations. This was a new realm that needed a solid theory. Scientists like Ernst Mach had some ideas and equations of how shockwaves worked back in the 19th century, but it took decades of hard work by researchers from different countries to really figure it out. Among the pioneers in this field was John Stack at the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, or NACA, the predecessor of NASA. Through years of painstaking research, collaboration with other aerodynamicists, John Stack made groundbreaking discoveries, like using thinner wing cross-sections and swept back wings. Models showed that this improved efficiency and stability near Mach 1 speeds. He published his work in the 1930s and 40s. It was brilliant and laid down the groundwork for high-speed aerodynamics. After the Second World War, the Americans captured German documents, and they revealed that they were working on some unconventional aircraft designs, exploring tailless, swept-wing aircraft, as well as utilizing rocket engines and other peculiar methods. Were the German scientists out of their minds, or were they onto something remarkable? Around this time, the US government contracted Bell Aircraft to find out. Their mission was to test what happens when an aircraft reaches that tricky speed of between Mach 0.8 and Mach 1.2, a speed range called transonic. Could they succeed where others had failed? The result was the Bell X-1. Now that the Germans were out of the race, it was between the British and Americans to see who could conquer supersonic flight. By looking at the orange-coloured Bell X-1, it looked remarkably similar to the M-52. So, some British homework had been stolen, but the bullet shape wasn't just to look cool. It provided stability and low drag at supersonic speeds. It also had short, straight wings, just like the M-52. Interestingly, captured German documents suggested that swept wings would be better suited for supersonic flight, but at the time, they weren't well understood. So the X-1 engineers chose the same wings as the British. Speaking of the British, how were they going? Across the pond, the M52 design was nearly complete by 1944, and Miles had received orders to build three prototypes. The test pilot chosen was the most decorated pilot in British history, Captain Eric Winkle Brown. With 400 different aircraft under his belt, Brown was sure that he could fly the M52 to its limit and break the sound barrier. But little did the British know that a deceptive deal would soon rob them of their hard efforts. In 1944, the British and American governments signed an agreement to exchange high-speed research and data. But unfortunately, the Americans cheated. According to Dennis Bancroft, Miles Aircraft chief aerodynamicist, the Americans visited the Miles workshop. They saw the drawings and research on the M52, and the British were happy to share the details with them. But in return, the Americans didn't share anything about their X-1 project. The deal massively helped the Americans, but the British got nothing in return. Unaware of the ongoing developments, British engineers at Miles kept working on the M52 project. They were at it for 2 years. Then, in a startling turn of events, the English government abruptly cancelled the project at the beginning of 1946. And this was just weeks before the first scheduled flight of the M52. The official reason cited doubts about its feasibility and safety, though some historians speculate that there were additional factors. Budget cuts or external pressure may have played a role. The cancellation of the M52 project was devastating to George Miles and his team. They had worked tirelessly for 4 years on the Dream Project. They felt betrayed by their own government and their American so-called allies. The cancellation also meant that Eric Brown lost his chance to become the first man to break the sound barrier. He later said that he was, quote, bitterly disappointed by that decision. The Americans continued with their X-1 project, now without any interference or competition from the British. In 1946, they already began test gliding. Jack Williams, who had completed the test flights, was unfortunately killed in an unrelated incident in his own test aircraft. Williams's death was a sad tragedy and a setback that would delay the supersonic flight. Testing would soon resume, however, with a new pilot, Chalmers Slick Goodlin. He completed 26 flights, including glides and subsonic tests. However, he never got to fly supersonic. The Air Force took over the testing from Bell because they were unhappy with the slow progress. Goodlin was then replaced with First Lieutenant Chuck Yeager. Born in 1923 in West Virginia, Yeager joined the US Army Air Force in 1941. He was a fighter pilot in World War II, where he flew P-51 Mustangs and shot down 12 enemy planes, including 5 in 1 day. He also survived being shot down over France and escaped with the help of the French resistance. He seemed like the perfect man for the job. In the lead up to the historic flight, Yeager wasted no time. In August of 1947, he began glide test flights and then swiftly progressed to powered flights by month's end. The Air Force's strategy was different to Bell's. They wanted to get things done quickly, whereas Bell wanted to go for a gradual speed increase. They gave Yeager full permission to push the boundaries of the aircraft towards Mach 1. On October 10th, he reached a remarkable speed of Mach 0.997. So close. Everything was in place now. Yeager was ready. He even named the aircraft Glamorous Glennis after his wife. But then, just a few days before the historic flight, something unexpected happened. Yeager would break two of his ribs in a horse riding accident. But he wasn't going to miss this opportunity for the world. He was going to etch his name in history. So he decided to hide his injuries from his superiors. On October 14th, 1947, the stage was set. It was a dry lake bed in California's Mojave Desert. A B-29 bomber carried the X-1 into the sky. Inside, Chuck Yeager held onto a modified broom handle that he used for his injury and closed the cockpit door. The X-1 smoothly glided past the bomb bay doors, and with a blast, its rocket engine ignited. This unique launch provided an exhilarating boost to 250 miles per hour. Under Yeager's skillful guidance, the Glamorous Glennis climbed to 43,000 feet. Engineers on the ground held their breath. They were fearful of aircraft instability. If anything went wrong, it could be lethal. They watched with bated breath as Yeager flew past Mach 1.06, experiencing only bow shock and a resulting sonic boom. With that loud and glorious thunder, Yeager had made history. He was the first person to fly supersonic.
This spectacular flight was one of the greatest achievements since the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk. Captain Yeager flew the X-1 faster than the speed of sound in level flight. The date, October 14th, 1947.
But it wouldn't be so clean-cut. George Welch, an American pilot, also claimed to break the sound barrier with his F-86 Sabre, the first American swept-wing fighter jet. Welch allegedly flew supersonic on October 1st, 1947, 2 weeks before Yeager. Although there were anecdotal reports of sonic booms being heard on the ground, this claim was disputed due to a lack of concrete evidence and data. Yeager, on the other hand, had a multitude of instruments and observations on the speed, so he is officially credited. Meanwhile, Miles Aircraft in England still persisted with their M52 model. After a failed attempt in 1947, they successfully reached supersonic speed with their final model in 1948. Although this was still remarkable, it was too little, too late, and the Bell X-1's achievement had overshadowed them. Even though the speed of sound was defeated, Chuck Yeager would still keep pushing the limits of speed. In December 1953, in a Bell X-1A, Chuck attempted to maneuver the aircraft at Mach 2.44. This caused the plane to enter an internal coupling event, which essentially means his plane flew violently out of control, resulting in a tumbling, spinning descent.
Oh. I'm getting bad tumbles. Down to 25,000. Would it have to be?
Somehow, he managed to recover the aircraft and then glide back to base and landed safely. Other pilots would die due to the same design flaw. It really does show how good of a pilot Chuck Yeager was. The news of Yeager's supersonic flight leaked despite attempts to keep it under wraps. The authorities wanted to protect their military and technological edge in the post-war era. An anonymous source tipped off the press. The Los Angeles Times reported it on December 22, 1947. The authorities continued denying and downplaying the achievement until June of 1948, when Yeager flew again, faster and higher in the same X-1. He flew at Mach 1.45, breaking his previous achievement and setting new world records. The news of supersonic flight caught the public's imagination and sparked a wave of interest. Yeager and his team would be hailed heroes and received several awards and honors. The Bell X-1 became an icon of supersonic flight and was donated to the Smithsonian Institution in 1950, where it's still on display today. As great as it was for the team, you can't help but feel for the British engineers who worked for 4 years only to get their work stolen. Regardless, the event encouraged many young people to pursue careers in aerodynamics, in aerospace engineering, and it inspired a whole new generation of pilots. So, what was the fastest plane humans ever made? Well, it might surprise you that the speed record for a level flight aircraft was set all the way back on the 3rd of October, 1967. It was a North American X-15. It got to a top speed of 4,520 miles per hour, or 7,274 kilometers an hour. After going so fast, here's some imagery of the damage caused by just the air rushing past. Unbelievable. Fun fact, a few years earlier in 1962, Neil Armstrong, the famous astronaut, would fly an X-15 to a speed of 3,989 miles per hour, or 6,420 kilometers an hour. A few months earlier, in another test flight, his X-15 ran out of fuel. It descended and bounced off the Earth's atmosphere, throwing him 50 miles off course.
Armstrong was falling back to Earth fast. And for several thousand feet, he couldn't maneuver the aircraft because of the thin atmosphere. Finally, he fell far enough that he could turn the X-15 and point it back towards Edwards Air Force Base, where he made an eventual safe landing.
From the 1960s onwards in the military, there was gradual innovation in regards to supersonic aviation. Some classic examples include the 1964 North American XB-70 Valkyrie. It was a bomber that could cruise at Mach 3 for thousands of miles. Only two were ever made. And this is a crazy story, but one of them sadly crashed when an escorting jet rolled and flew into the tail structure of the Valkyrie. So why was this jet flying so close? Because General Electric, who made the Valkyrie's engines, wanted a cool photo shoot for an ad. After this accident, it was basically the end of the project. Then, there's also the 1966 Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird, one of the most iconic aircraft. While it was in service till 1999, it was used for aerial reconnaissance, and it could reach speeds of up to Mach 3.2. Another classic is the 1986 Rockwell B-1 Lancer, a variable-wing heavy bomber that could cruise at Mach 1.2. And then, of course, there's a plethora of fighter jets, like the 1997 F-22 Raptor and the 2006 F-35 Lightning II, both built by Lockheed Martin. The Russians had their MiG series, the French company Dassault released a few jets, and Sweden's Saab had many notable examples too. So that's all in the military, but what about the civilian side of things? As you've just seen, the first supersonic flight ignited a new era of innovations in the field. Many new models were built and flown, and the aviation industry thrived. So not knowing any better, for a person in the past, it would be natural to think that commercial supersonic flight would exist today. But it doesn't. Well, of course, there have been some attempts in the past. You've all heard of the Concorde. It was a supersonic passenger airline service, flying from 1976 to 2003. It began as a joint venture in 1956 between France and England. It crossed the Atlantic in less than half the time of a conventional aircraft. The Concorde was famously retired in 2003 after a fatal accident. Debris on the tarmac punctured a tire, which in turn caused a fire under one of the wings. The plane subsequently crashed into a hotel, killing 109 people on the plane and 4 on the ground.
For the first time in more than 30 years in its history, a Concorde has crashed. And that's where we start. It was an Air France Concorde chartered by a German tour company. It had just taken off from Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris when something cataclysmic happened in at least one of the 4 engines. In this picture, you can see a long stream of smoke and fire as the pilot struggled to gain altitude. He failed. And when the plane crashed in the grounds of a small rural hotel in Gonesse, just outside Paris, 100 passengers, mostly German, 1 American, 9 crew, all French, and 4 people on the ground were killed.
What's lesser known is that the Americans also tried their hand, and in 1961, the US government awarded Boeing, mistake, and Lockheed Martin contracts to build supersonic aircraft, but budget cuts killed both projects in the 1970s. The former Soviet Union entered the race with the Tu-144, and that's worth a mention. An interesting note is that it was the world's first supersonic transport aircraft, flying 2 months before the Concorde in 1968. Although sources debate whether it was an original design or stolen through espionage, the Tu-144 outperformed the Concorde and reached a top speed of Mach 2.15. But that's about where the positives end. The aircraft was plagued with poor handling and engine reliability, as well as high fuel consumption. Then, in 1973, tragedy would strike. At a Paris air show, a Tu-144 crashed fatally, killing all 6 crew members and 8 people on the ground. And this was in front of 250,000 spectators. The accident ruined the aircraft's business prospects. Potential customers became very wary of its safety and performance. So, what went wrong with commercial supersonic transport? Well, basically, the planes were extremely expensive to make and maintain. They were fuel-hungry and loud. And routine sonic booms cause health concerns and environmental concerns. It can cause stress to people and animals, and even damage nearby buildings. These factors have led to the prohibition of routine supersonic flight over many land countries. But on the brighter side, there are some new ongoing efforts to revive supersonic transport. Companies like Boom Technology.
Symphony is a new propulsion system for supersonic flight, a boom-led development with world-class partners.
And Spike Aerospace.
So is that the main technological challenge you're trying to overcome? Is the sonic boom, or is it the efficiency end of it?
It's actually both of it. I mean, you can fly fast. There's no problem doing it. Military jets do it all the time, right? But they're burning a lot of fuel. And that's just not going to work for flying passengers from New York to London or London to Hong Kong. You got to be able to fly at a reasonable cost, and you got to be able to fly without making a sonic boom, without disturbing people on the ground. It's a very loud, disturbing sound, and that's critical. And that's what Spike Aerospace has been developing, a technology to cut that sonic boom down tremendously.
Working on new supersonic aircraft with improved efficiency and reduced noise. NASA and Lockheed Martin are collaborating on a project called the X-59 Quest. It aims to demonstrate quieter supersonic travel with drastically reduced sonic booms. It was officially unveiled in January of 2024 and will take its first flight later this year.
Behold our stunning X-59. What a unique aircraft. The challenges of sonic booms accompanying supersonic flight. We've talked a little bit about it. So this design is really critical in dispersing shock waves, which today shocks are formed around the aircraft and then they merge together to give that boom. By designing it to disperse those, they never merge together. And that's how they solved this problem.
It's hoped that the design lessons learned from this aircraft will enable quiet supersonic travel in the future. And last, but definitely not least, is Hermes, an American company that aims to make hypersonic jets that can travel at Mach 5. First for military applications, and then later for commercial travel.
We'd be kind of naive to go try and build a 20-passenger Mach 5 aircraft right off the bat. The number of technical challenges, you know, between where we stand today and there are many. You know, we take a very iterative approach to development that's focused on getting to hardware very quickly.
We have the opportunity to pull in significant private dollars alongside government investment to solve pressing national security challenges. This government partnership helps us to incrementally de-risk the tech and solve problems for our customer while marching down the roadmap towards commercial flight.
Check out the YouTube channel Real Engineering's video for more info on the topic. We'll have to wait and see if any of these projects become a reality, but it's just cool to know that there are people out there working hard to make them become a reality. So, the race to supersonic flight was frantic and fraught with danger and even betrayal, beginning with the desperation of war and culminating in engineers taming the untamable. It was supposed to be the apex of future travel, but so far, reality has dictated the outcome. But maybe not for long. You could say that air travel is safer because of the discoveries made along the way. But the human sacrifice to get to such a point shouldn't be forgotten. I found this whole story so interesting. I just wanted to cover it. I know it's not going to be for everyone, but I hope that you did like it too. Hopefully, we'll see supersonic travel once again over the next few decades. So what do you guys think? Do you think we'll have supersonic passenger aircraft in our lifetimes? Or will it forever be a pipe dream? Let me know in the comments section below. Here's a quick word from today's sponsor, Nebula. Nebula is a streaming platform for creators and by creators. Started as a way to free creators from the limitations of YouTube, the company has become one of the most interesting and fastest growing independent video platforms on the internet. If you're particularly interested in thought-provoking content, Nebula is a great place to discover exclusives and original content from creators you may be familiar with. For example, I've covered a couple of aviation stories on Cold Fusion recently, and out of interest, I was looking at some content on Nebula. I stumbled on this exclusive by Neo on the Tenerife disaster, the worst crash in aviation history. There's also a lot of other interesting shows, like Modern Conflicts by Real Life Law, which goes into the depths of geopolitics, or there's The Logistics of X, which covers the minute details of planning and organization behind some of the biggest global projects. Nebula also recently got their biggest update ever. The homepage has a new look and an improved UI, so you can find content based on categories, like news, culture, science, history, and more. You can watch Cold Fusion videos there ad-free, and that goes for every creator on Nebula. And right now, for a limited time, Nebula is selling lifetime memberships that will last as long as both you and Nebula exist. You pay $300 once, and that's it. No monthly fees or anything else. You'll have access forever. Click the link below to get started. Clicking the link helps support Cold Fusion, so thank you. And that is the story of supersonic flight. I want to thank you for watching the whole way through. If you did like this and want to see anything on science, technology, or business, feel free to subscribe to Cold Fusion. My name is Dagogo, and I'll catch you again soon for the next episode. Cheers, guys. Have a good one.